Sahanabhunaktu, Sahaviryam karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu, Mahavishabhai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
So one of you should be. The Sahanabhavatu is actually the Shantipat that goes with this particular Upanishad.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So it goes with the other one too. It's Mundaka or Mandakya. I have to look it up again. the Katha Upanishad, it's really from the Rishi Katha. It's part of the Yajurveda, so each Upanishad has several Vedas associated with it. This is part of the Yajurveda. it is really a dialogue between Lord Yama and Nachiketa, the young boy whose father sent him up to be with Yama. So we're gonna take a look at that whole story. But before we look at the story, this particular Upanishad has an introduction, which is really a nice introduction, in terms of talking about the meaning of the word Upanishad, what exactly an Upanishad is. It's a very famous introduction, actually, so I'm going to not do the whole bhasha, but I'm going to tell you here everything that this commentary says. And then... in his introduction to the, in his exposition on the meaning of the word Upanishad, he also talks about what we call the Anubandha Chatushtaya. The Anubandha Chatushtaya, as we'll see a little bit later on, it's really the four elements that really bind you to a text, the four things that you need to know that would even cause you to be interested in a text. You have to know who the Adhikari is, who's the qualified student, what the subject matter is, What are you going to get out of studying it, Paula? What are you going to get out of studying it? And also, what's the connection between your studying the text and the result that you're hoping to get? So these, chatushtaya means a fourfold, right? So these fourfold connect me to the particular study is called the Anubandha Chatushtaya. And so what Shankara is saying is that when we analyze this word Upanishad, this Anubandha Chatushtaya, these four things that link me or actually capture me in terms of my interest to study the text are there to be found in this breakdown of the word Upanishad. Okay, so that's what we're going to look at as part of the introduction here. But there's just some things just to familiarize yourself with Shankara a little bit. He starts his commentary saying, Om Namo Bhagavate Vaishvataya Mrityave Brahmavidyacharyaya Nachiketasecha. So simple. It's a prayer. He says, Om Namaha. My salutations to Bhagawan. Vaivaswat is the one who is the son of the sun, the son of Surya, which is Lord Death, Yama. So my salutations to Mrityu, so is Lord Yama, who is considered to be the son of the sun, sun S-U-N, Surya. Brahmavidyacharya, who is the Acharya.
Where's this introductory prayer?
Yeah. If you have this in the Katha Upanishad, it's only going to be here. It's not given as a prayer. It's part of the introduction. You have it in English here. Mm-hmm. That's why I said if you can get this Katha Upanishad, for most of you don't know Sanskrit, but this commentary is a direct translation of the Sanskrit by Gambhirananda. That's why I advise you to, when we're doing an Upanishad, to be able to get these Gambhirananda's translation, because even if you're learning Sanskrit, until you're really fluent in Sanskrit, you need to use this as kind of a crutch. It works really well because he stays so closely to the Sanskrit. It's wonderful, you know. Even Swamiji uses it. If there's something, he'll see, well, what would Gambhir understand about this? Sometimes the Shankara, this happens to be easy Sanskrit. I'll tell you why in a minute. But sometimes Shankara's Sanskrit is, you know, it's really hard. So you get other commentaries of commentaries and commentaries on commentaries to understand what he's saying. But Shankara, as far as Sanskrit goes, he's considered, his Sanskrit is so eloquent, it's so direct, it's so simple in a sense, even though if you're a Sanskritist, you might not feel it's simple, but it's very pure, you know, it's very clean and very pure. So what he's doing here is he's always whatever commentary you do, it always begins with a prayer, right? So he just starts first of all, with a simple prayer just to Lord Yama, who's Mrityu. Mrityu means death, the one who's the Lord of death. And just in terms of all of the mythology and the stories, Lord Death has come, is the son of the sun. Okay? So he says, my salutations to Lord Death, who is the Brahma Vidya Acharya, to the salutations to Yama, who is the teacher here of this Brahma Vidya, and also to Nachiketas. Nachiketas is the young boy, right, who's been sent to death by his father. So we'll see this story. So we start saying, I pranams to Lord Yama and to Nachiketas, because this dialogue comes to us through them, right? So my pranams. So then Shankara says another thing. He says, Atha, now. Atha means now I'm going to begin this commentary. So Atha. Then he says, Katakopanishad Vali Nam Sukarta Prabodhanartam. This Sukarta Prabodhanartam, he says, now for, he says, well, let me make it, Upagrantha Vrittihi Arabhyate. He says this, I am going to begin this very short, simple exposition called a vritti. I'm going to begin this vritti, which is a short exposition on the volis of this Upanishad. So the volis are the different chapters of this Kataka or Katha Upanishad. I'm going to begin this very brief, terse exposition on the chapters of this Upanishad. Why? Sukha Artha Prabodhanartham. For the sake of the easy understanding. Right? For the sake of your easy, simple, clear understanding. So when somebody begins, in India traditionally, when somebody begins to write a commentary, they have to have a reason. Why are you doing this? Are you just adding another book to mm-hmm. You know? So you should have a good reason for doing it. Now often, for the acharyas will say the main reason is for my own clarity. I'm writing this book for my own clarity. That's one common. The other very common meaning is I'm writing it for my students, for the easy understanding of my students, for the easy understanding, for the clear understanding of the mumukshus. I'll say, of the mumukshus. For the mumukshus, this is for their easy understanding. When Shankara normally, he doesn't really usually write vrittis. What a vritti is it is a commentary on the immediate meaning of the Upanishads, of the particular Upanishad, without going into this Purva Paksha Siddhanta. Purva Paksha Siddhanta means this argument. But it could be like this, and this, they bring in an objector, and that objector comes and asks a question, and then they go into a Siddhanta where that question is answered, and go on and on and on like that. That's a bhasha. When the focus is really just on the meaning of the words, right? Then we call it a vritti. It's not going into all the Purva Paksha Siddhanta. So he's calling this a vritti. even though there is a little bit of questioning, but the questioning is really only for the clarification of the meaning of the sentence. So he says, this Alpagranta minimum words, okay? This Ritvi, this commentary of minimum words, small, is being begun for the easy understanding of the students of all, for the easy understanding of the meaning, artha is meaning, you know, for the students, for the mumukshus, he says. So now he decides to start, after this little introduction, to start by giving the breakdown of the word Upanishad. So, I'm just going to tell you mostly in English here, is this. If you take the word Upanishad, the actual root of the word is sad, S-A-D, sad. And there are two prefixes to the word. One is upa, and one is ni. Okay? The root sad itself, it's called the dhatu, it has three major meanings. The sad dhatu. One is visharana. Visharana means to, like, destroy, or splinter, or shatter. To destroy and to kill, to destroy, to ruin, okay? Visharana. Another one, second meaning, is gati. Gati means to reach, to attain something, to go to something, to obtain something. A third one is avasadana. Avasadana means to loosen something or to weaken something. So he's giving these three meanings of this root sad. Now, just as an aside, the root sad becomes shud when it's preceded by any vowel other than a or a. So now if we say upa plus ni plus sad, it's preceded by ni, so it becomes shud. So we have Upanishad. For that shud to just end in a consonant, it has to take a quip affix. It has to take a little pratyaya that makes it the word itself end in that da, Upanishad. It's not Upanishada, it's Upanishad. Mm-hmm. Right? That's called a quip affix. And that quip affix is something that gives what we call kartritvam, doership, to the noun. So this noun, Upanishad, is something which does something, right? It's got doership. It actually accomplishes something, this Upanishad, okay? So now he's going to tell us what does it accomplish, okay? So what he says here, first thing he says is, first of all, Pratyaya upa, it means near. So if I have the word upa as a not word, a preposition stuck onto the root, it means near. Now this near, sometimes I'll translate it as near, it means near the teacher, approaching the teacher. But it also can be what is the most near. And I am the most near. There's nothing more near to me than me. Right? So I am upa. So if you say that which is directed at me, you can even say directed at the ahankara. I'll get into that in a minute. Because the ahankara is where the ajnanam is resting. The ahankara is the I notion, right? I am this, I am this body, I am this mind. But that ahankara is centered on me, this conscious being. So upa, that which is most near. Ni means called nishtya. Nishtya means clarity. So I'm going to approach something with clarity and perseverance. It has both of these meanings, clarity and commitment. Perseverance means where the word he used is shilyanti. Shilyanti means, if I say it's shila, it's something that has become habitual to me. This is what I do. This is my commitment. And my commitment is toward nischaya jnanam, that ni for nischaya. Mm-hmm. Nischaya jnanam. Nischaya jnanam means a knowledge which is free from doubt. In fact, we don't consider something a knowledge if it's free from doubt, it's still an inquiry. You're inquiring into something and you think, well, God could be this. So, this Nishtya Jnanam means free from doubt. So, Swamiji used to call it, what do you say? You know, it's a... He used to give the example for Nishtya Jnanam of digging a post hole. And remember this? He's used it so many times. When we're talking about clarity, knowledge that is free from doubt, that you can't shake. Knowledge that is not shakable. So he would use the example of if you dig a post hole and you stick a post in it, then you have to, the post is still, you know, not firm. So you have to pack it with more earth and then shake it again. It's still not firm. But then you pack it again, shake, pack, until you cannot shake it anymore, right? So your mind, it's a really beautiful example for your mind. Because your mind is the one that has to have clarity. The teacher may have some clarity, but that's not helpful to you. It's only helpful to you in whether or not the teacher can help you to recognize that clarity in yourself so that your mind says, yeah, I can't shake it anymore. It's clear. That's Nishtya Jnanam. When one has a knowledge, it is free from doubt. Until then, it's really not knowledge. It's still inquiry. But when it's free from doubt, it's not really something that you have to think about anymore. Because the doubts have gone away, the vision is clear around that. So this Nishtya Jnanam, when we say it, we shouldn't have to even say it, actually. Right? We shouldn't have to say it because otherwise, we can't really consider that as knowledge. Right? But when we're inquiring, we're inquiring into a knowledge which has to become nishchit, free of that type of doubt. Okay, so that's what we mean by the ni. Okay. So now, upa is that which is most near. Ni is that mind that has that commitment to gain that clarity of knowledge. You know, so then it will resolve into the clarity of knowledge. And sad, the first meaning of sad, is that which destroys. So that what destroys, what is it going to destroy? What the Upanishad now has to destroy something, giving this Nishtya Jnanam of that which is most near. Okay. So that which is most near. So what does he say? Shankara says for that, the mumukshu, it's for the mumukshu, right? It has to destroy Vishadanam, he translates as himsanat. It's from the destruction of the seeds of samsara bija, which begins with ajnanam. So this Upanishad is something which destroys, avasadana first means, it destroys the seed of samsara, which has its beginning in self-ignorance. That destroy it, okay? So that's the first, that's his first meaning. And then he gives an example from this Katha Upanishad. Nichayatam mrityumukhat pramuchyate. Having understood this, nichaya means having understood that this, he is liberated from the mouth of death. Mrityumukhat, right? Having gained this knowledge, he is freed. He is released from the jaws of death. That's the example that he gives. So that's the first meaning, taking the first meaning of this root sud. Okay? The second meaning of the root sud is has to do with gati. It has to do with attaining or reaching. And so now he does it in terms of that. And what he says that because the Upanishad is the one that causes me to reach, causes me to attain Brahman. How is it going to cause me to attain Brahman? Because Brahman is that which is most dear near, right? It causes me to attain that which is most near. And the ni remains the same through Nishtya Jnanam. So here, that's the key. Here the attainment is through knowledge. It's not the attainment of something that is away from me. It's actually the attainment of myself. But that attainment of myself is the attainment of myself as Brahman. So that's the jnanam there. This which is most near is Brahman. And so the Upanishad, the knowledge, the Upanishad itself, which is this teaching, right, is something which gives me myself as Brahman. Okay, so that's the second meaning. And then the third meaning is really interesting. It avasadana means the avasadana means loosening or weakening. So he says the third meaning is for Saguna Brahman. First two are Nirguna Brahman, non-dual, just non-dual Satchitananda me. The third meaning is for Saguna Brahman. Because Nachiketas, just a little aside, Nachiketas was offered three boons by Lord Yama. One of the boons that he gave was the Nachiketas ritual, fire ritual, which allowed the people who performed that ritual to go to heaven. We'll see why he asked for that boon later. To go to Swargaloka. Swargaloka exists within the whole Saguna Brahman, the whole Maya Upadi as Ishwara. But that in that Swargaloka, there really is no kartritvam, there's no doership, there's no death, there's no, as we'll see in detail later, there's no thirst or hunger, there's no wanting or needing, there's no ill health, no birth or death while you're there. It's all relative, but while you're there, you're free of all of that. And so what happens in this Swargaloka is it loosens, it weakens the misery. It loosens and it dilates the misery that is usually available here within duality. So if you go to Swargaloka, a lot of that misery is released. You're released from it. It's not completely gone because there's still duality and there's somebody who's getting more than you are. And some are getting less. But nevertheless, you know, there's no distance between you and the fulfillment of your desire. And there's no physical suffering. Or you're not wanting for anything, you know. And so the bonds of samsara are kind of mitigated a little bit. Even though you're still bound by time and you still, you know, when the creation goes into its unmanifest condition, your time is gone, right? You might have been there for a million years, but it does come to an end. So it only mitigates it. So that's the third meaning they have of the Upanishad. One that gives you a relative release from suffering. A relative, that's the key right there. It's a relative release from suffering. So it mitigates the suffering that most of us have to go through. And he includes this third meaning in the Upanishad also because Nachiketas wanted his father, who sent him to hell out of anger, didn't want him to suffer, and he wanted him to be able to go to Swargaloka because that's where his values were. Give him a ritual, you know, so that he could go there and enjoy and have more shanti, have a better life. So that's the idea. Anyway. This is the meaning of this word, Upanishad. A little, Shankara does a little inquiry here and has an objector come along and say, you're talking about this Upanishad, which has this quip affix, means that the Upanishad is something that actually does something. Mm-hmm. The Upanishad means, the word itself means it gives knowledge to the mumukshu, right? To release them from bondage. And then one of the three is the relative bondage by extending the Swarga. The other two are just released by removing the samsara, by removing the ajnanam. That Upanishad does this. It itself releases you from bondage. That's very important because, as we'll see when we get into this Anubandha Chatushtaya, it's not like it tells you, it gives you a knowledge, and then you have to go do something. like, say I'm teaching you, Swamiji will use the example, they use it in these in the text that we study, like cooking. Say if I give you a lecture on cooking, how to make golden turmeric almond milk. And I give you a lecture, all the ingredients, I tell you exactly how to do it, not to boil it, when to put the coconut oil and everything, tell you exactly how to do it. Very clear, very clear. But now that you have this knowledge, now you have to go and make it, right? The knowledge itself is not the result. But here, for the Upanishad, the knowledge is the result. The knowledge is the result because it is the removal of ajnana. See what I mean? That's not true for the third one. The third one, as we'll see, is complicated. Mrityu, Lord Yama, gave all the instructions to Nachiketas, how to do this, how to lay the bricks, all of the things that have to be done. He told him all of this. And then he had Nachiketas repeat it back, make sure that he got it clearly, because now he has a job. He's got something he has to do, and he's got to go teach people how to do this, and they have to perform the ritual. But so that's the Guna Brahman, going to Swarga. But the primary meaning of the Upanishad is not going to Swarga Loka. The primary meaning of the Upanishad is the removal of the self-ignorance, which is the cause for this samsara, for this bondage. That removal of ajnanam is itself the liberation. That's the thing. There's no, it's not like cooking. You know? Like when this knowledge takes place, the liberation takes place. That's also why it's this nischa jnanam. That's why the student has to be intent on gaining that clarity, because knowledge is not knowledge without clarity. You have to really see it, you have to really understand it, or it's not knowledge. But if that clarity is there, the liberation is there, because the one, they're one and the same, right? Knowledge is liberation, which means, of course, that if the knowledge itself is the liberation, that means that liberation is already an existent fact. Knowledge doesn't create something. It's not creating liberation, it's revealing liberation. Knowledge reveals the fact of what is actually there. And so that's what the nature of the Upanishad itself is, something which itself gives liberation with, in terms of knowledge, with nothing else to be done. So Shlen Shankara brings up this little doubt, and he says, well, the objector says, the Upanishad gives liberation, but what about the book? Does the book, which we call an Upanishad, like this is an Upanishad, right? This book is an Upanishad. This book isn't giving anything. And he says, no, it's okay, don't worry. This is the secondary meaning of the word Upanishad. This is holding the material that has to be taught, and so we can refer to it as an Upanishad. But the Upanishad itself, in primary meaning, is the knowledge which liberates. That is its, that karmic term, that's what it does. So that's an important point there. And then Shankara says, you know, the word Upanishad also, it is really, is answering the Anubandha Chatushtya, these fourfold things that anybody needs to know in order to commit themselves to a study, right? The first, so the Anubandha means these four links. We call them links, but what they do are these fourfold understandings that are necessary for you to know if you're going to study a text. Otherwise, why would you study it? You don't even have any idea what it's about. So the first one of these anubandhas is the adhikari, right? And so here, the adhikari is what we call the one who has the sadhana chatushtaya. Adhikari means qualified student. The qualified student really is the mumukshu. The mumukshu is the one who desires liberation, right? So that's one of the qualifications, the mumukshu. If the person's not a mumukshu, then
there's no reason to study this because you haven't recognized the problem. But to be a mumukshu, mumukshu comes from this root much, which means to liberate. So mumukshu is the one who desires liberation, the one who desires to be free. It's a desiderative. So the adhikari is the mumukshu. How did the adhikari, this student, become a mumukshu? Well, the first thing is they have gained a viveka. A discrimination took place in their nice little mind. A discrimination took place in terms of the assimilation of their experience, and that discrimination is that everything that we experience in the world, internally and externally, is anitya. Anitya means it's bound by time. So that's the first thing. It is bound by time. The question then comes, is there anything that is not bound by time? Because, so this is called viveka, this discrimination between nitya and anitya. Of course, for the adhikari, for the qualified student, the nitya isn't known. What is known is all of this is time bound. There aren't any exceptions. Everything that exists within time and space, internally or externally, every experience I have is time bound. If it is time bound, it can only give me temporary experiences. Let me put it like this. If experience itself is time bound, then that experience is temporary. Okay? If the experience of happiness is time bound, the experience of happiness is temporary. As long as my experience of happiness or joy or pleasure is dependent on something that exists within time, that experience is going to go. That's why the Buddha said, all experiences of happiness are dukkha yonis. They're wombs of dukkha. Mm-hmm. Because all experience goes, including my happy experiences, because they exist within time. If they exist within time, finished. If you're a commitment, or if your desire is for something that is bound by time, whatever the result of that acquisition is going to also be bound by time. There's not a thing you can do about it. And so once that viveka is there, that all of this, all experience is time bound, vairagya comes next. That vairagya comes next because that's not what I really want. That's fine. Let me have this little happiness here and happiness there. That's not what I want. What I really want is to be able to say, okay, everything is fine with me and it's not going to change now. I am well and whole and complete. That's who I am. Nobody can do anything about it. It's finished. That means that for that to be so, there has to be something which is free of time. Because I can't say that if my experience is time-bound. I'm not talking about some bliss state. I just want to be myself. To be myself, to feel like myself, but myself always seems to be slipping away. So the vairagya comes. So the viveka and vairagya, the mumukshutvam comes because this is the problem. The mumukshutvam, the desire for liberation, comes because there is nothing here that's not bound by time. So I cannot solve this problem. You know? See that? If I can solve the problem, if I think I can solve the problem, I'm not a mumukshu. The Upanishad is not meant for me because I still think there's something I can do. So I'm not an adhikari for this knowledge because I know that I can solve this problem myself by getting this and getting that and getting that. I haven't realized yet. But once I realize, then I become a mumukshu. I can't solve the problem. That's a mumukshu. If I can solve it, I'm not a mumukshu. then for this IndyCar, they have this group of six qualifications, which are interesting. They stick it in here, these six qualifications. And I think that they're there because once you have this Viveka Vairagya and Mumukshutvam, once these are there, the world doesn't have a hold on you in the same way. Because you know it's not, can't give you what you want. It's not the most happy state. It's kind of the dark night of the soul, in a way. Because you don't know what can give you but what you want. But the world doesn't have that hold. And so that actually can help a certain maturing happen in your mind with this group of qualifications. The first one, we've been through these before, so just to remind you, let me go through them. The shama. Shama is the mental, these are six mental states. Shama is my ability to let thoughts pass on through. I have a control. If I don't want that thought, or that feeling, or that emotion, I can let it go. That's shama. Dhamma comes along when I can't let it go. The other thoughts are passing through, and or emotions, if one gets me, then I'm captured by it. Dhamma means, even though I'm captured by it, I don't act it out. I can control, I can keep it to myself. I don't have to spew or beat up somebody or speak, you know, speak with anger at somebody. That's Dhamma. So Dhamma comes in when Shama fails. Upadhiti is that ability to not be a dilettante. A dilettante is somebody who stays this for a little while, stays this for a little while, but doesn't have whatever, that fortitude to be able to stay with something and master it. That's a certain type of mind. So they say for a mumukshu, that upadhiti is what we call sannyasa. Sannyasa doesn't have to mean taking the orange. But sannyasa means that I'm single-pointed in my focus, because how could I not be if I have the viveka and vairagya? And that mumukshutvam is there. Then that's what I'm primarily doing. This is the situation. This is what has to be answered. And nothing else can do that. I've seen that clearly. So that upadhiti comes into play there. Then there's titiksha. Titiksha is my ability to endure or to accommodate the opposites. Like if it's cold and I wanted to, you know, go and lie in the sun at the beach. It's cold out. It's cold and, you know. Or we were all going to go skiing and it's hot out. All the snow is melting. You know, what if that's fine? I can accommodate these changes in the world. I can accommodate the opposites that are coming my way. I'm not relying on them to make me happy. So that gives a tremendous freedom. You know, we all have titiksha for like 98% of our experiences. Mm-hmm. It's that 2%. Mm-hmm. You know. But you think of those five or six things, you know, that titiksha is not there, and that's where you get caught. But that titiksha is the ability to adjust to the environment without having it throw you off too much. Samadhanam is kind of like upadhiti in a way. Upadhiti means I can, over the long term, stay with something. Samadhanam is my mind, say, during a lecture, or if I'm reading a book, or you're experiencing, committing yourself to this teaching, that my mind is actually able to be present during the teaching, instead of flying off there and flying off there, you know? Then you find you're maybe at the class for 10% of the class, or 15% of the class. The same when you're reading a book, you know, or watching TV, or whatever you're doing, what percentage of the time is your mind actually there? So samadhanam is the ability to keep your mind in place. And then shraddha is considered, of everything, the most important. in terms of getting this knowledge. And what Shraddha is, that the really thing is Ishwara Nugraha, it's just Bhagavan's grace. But something tells you that this is it. This is what you want to learn. This is what you want. This study is what you want. And this teacher will do it for you. Mm. Both. It's both the Acharya and the Upadesha. Mm. That Shraddha is there. If the Shraddha is not there, first of all, well, Vedanta is, I don't know. I don't know. It's okay. The commitment can't be there with that attitude. It might grow, but it just hasn't struck you to the point where your mind has a commitment. Or the teacher, also the teacher's okay, but you know, he or she is not my teacher. That really, really matters, because your whole heart, you have to be there in order to get this, because this knowledge is taking place through words. So actually what's happening, and I remember this for myself, when you're teacher-student, for the teacher and for the student, there's no teacher or student there. It's only this knowledge is taking place. That's it. The ahankara of the teacher's not there, ahankara of the student is not there. Just this knowledge is taking place. So we're all in the background, you know? And we pray for that whenever we do the Shantipatha. We're praying for that. That there be no obstructions in Sahanagavatu, that the teacher, let there be no obstructions between us. Because if there's an obstruction, then that's where your mind is when the teaching is taking place. It's focused on that obstruction or on that annoyance, or he or she said this or said that. And so then there's not that transmission or that flow of knowledge, so that what the teacher is seeing at the time of teaching, the student is seeing exactly the same thing. That's the pramana. That's how, when we talk about this, is a pramana. So Shraddha, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a verse, a Shraddhavan Labhate Jnanam. The one who has Shraddha gains this knowledge. The one who has Shraddha gains this knowledge. Without the Shraddha, that channel isn't there for this knowledge to take place. Remember, the knowledge itself is the result. It's not like you read some books and everything, kind of understand it, and then you go do something so that you can gain it. No. And that's what we've been led to believe in this country. You know, you study the books, and then you yourself, this is a big ahankara, you yourself go and, you know, you meditate on it and all this. But then you're meditating on something you don't know. This is the whole difference. In the Vedanta and the Upanishad gives the knowledge. You're contemplating on the knowledge that you have gained at the time of teaching. That's what you're doing the Nididhyasana on. It's something that you know. You're not doing Nididhyasana in order to get an experience of yourself. So it's like the Upanishads have said, there is a Brahman. That Brahman is infinite. That's your nature. Go meditate and figure that out. So realize that. It's not enough. But the problem, I mean, there's a lot of problems with that. But one of them is that you have experiences all the time. You can go have an experience, but you don't have any clarity around that experience. And here, yourself is not a new experience. In the whole teaching of the Upanishads, they are pointing to an experience that is already here. And so that's a problem for us, because when we think of gaining enlightenment, we're thinking about gaining, you know, some almost like an occult or magical experience. But we're going to gain a special experience that would make me be an enlightened being, kind of like Jesus walking on the water, you know? But if knowledge is liberation, the experience is already here. You can't be more here than you are. That's not possible. And so The knowledge itself has to remove the ajnanam, the self-ignorance that's causing you to do this misidentification with your body, mind, sense organs, and become a little jiva in this world. That ignorance has to be removed. But even in the removal of that ignorance, you're not gaining a new experience of yourself. You're just recognizing that I've taken me to be wearing all these dresses, as though the dresses were stuck on me. You know, the dresses of my mind and the dress of my body, as though these go together. Even though all of these experiences are coming and going and coming and going, I never even think about that. I just take myself to be the one having all of these experiences, as though I'm becoming sad, I'm becoming happy, I'm becoming agitated, I was young and now I'm old, etc. I was healthy and now I'm sick. It's all just muddled together. Without my recognizing, without the mind recognizing that it itself is coming and going in something which is absolutely changeless and stable and free of time, actually, and free of space. That's what has to take place. But you're not gaining a new experience. You're just recognizing that the experience of yourself, the me that I've always been, is actually free. The me that I've always known, that I've always been, that has always been me, I recognize as free. That is not a meditative experience. That is an experience that is there in every experience that you've ever had. You know? Nothing wrong with meditative experiences. It's only when you take the meditative experience to be you, and then the experience goes away, and now you've lost yourself again. You have to recognize the one who's not going away. The experiences will always go away. Meditative experiences or problematic experiences, all experiences will go away. So that is what we call the adhikari. The next is the vishya, the subject matter. The subject matter is the jiva brahma akim. That yourself, this atma, this self that I am, is infinite, non-dual self of the creation. This jiva, this atma, is Brahman. That's the subject matter. The sambandha, the connection between the text. Well, let me do the pala. The third one is the pala. The result of this knowledge, right, is that I am limitless, I am Brahman. That's the result. Means all of the ajnanam, all of the samsara has gone away, and I recognize my being as free, as limitless. That's the pola. The sambandha is that which what is between the vishya, the subject matter, and the result. What is the subject matter? What's the between the book, between the text, between the teaching and the pola? Is it like cooking? I study the text and then I go do something. No, the text is that which reveals the truth of your being. So that's called the sambandha. So these are called the anubandha chatushtaya, which the adhikari, the qualified student. What is the subject matter? What is the pala? What is the result of doing this teaching? So doing this study? What do I get from it? You know? And then what is the relationship between the teaching itself and that result? So it's called the anubandha chatushtaya. And he says all of these are really contained in the word Upanishad. And so that's his introduction to this text.
And before it was written down, it was recited.
Books came much, much later. These were all the Upanishads were passed down by heart. And the commentaries, they memorized everything and just passed them on that way. Then later they were written down on banana leaves.
A little bit more than the fox and the grapes. Yeah.
Are there any other studies that promise this result?
Within the Vedic culture, you have the Upanishads, which are the Shruti, the revealed knowledge, called the Upanishads, and the Vedas themselves. You've got that. And then you've got
all of the prakarana granthas, like Atma Bodha and those type of things, which reveal, which unfold the Upanishads. And then you have the Brahma Sutras. The Brahma Sutras are all the logical analysis, those type of things. Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmane Vyashivamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshati Parajanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Shobharahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sukhamaya Tamaso Ma